and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, marine biologist Jennifer Kate and aquatic biologist Josh Maffey discuss their work looking at the endangered Cook Inlet beluga whale population in a discussion entitled, Where Have All the Whales Gone? The Cook Inlet Beluga Whale Story. This talk was recorded at and hosted by the Anchorage Museum on January 29th and has been shortened for broadcast. The discussion was accompanied by PowerPoint slides, which we've provided a link to on our website, alaskapublic.org. Just look for the Addressing Alaskans icon on the right. Jennifer Kate began the discussion.
So the title, the question for the day is, where have all the whales gone? And this is highly focused on the Cook Inlet beluga whale population. But in order to understand what's going on with them, you kind of need to know a little bit of background information. And that includes biology, that includes location, why are they only in Cook Inlet, that kind of stuff. So about myself, my name is Jen Kate. I have a PhD in marine biology. And I started off in Texas doing marine biology down there, but I was actually a cave diver. So I was going into caves and looking at their ecosystems and seeing how pollution was changing those ecosystems because they're quite critical and quite isolated. So that's what I did my master's on. And then I moved to New Zealand because cave diving is kind of a dangerous hobby. And I started studying fur seal behavior and how tourism was affecting the behavior, and if we could develop a management plan with the New Zealand government so that tourism can thrive, but it won't impact the New Zealand fur seals or at their breeding grounds too much. And with that, I got a little bit of animal handling experience. And in my summers, I started doing protective species observer work up here in Alaska. So I would come from New Zealand and go up here and work in the Chukchi Sea on boats. And about 2 years ago, I moved up to Cook Inlet, and I'm working as a full-time environmental consultant for an environmental consulting firm here as a marine biologist. So that's about my background. It's not really in belugas, so that's why I'm giving the general talk on this. Josh is our beluga expert for the day. So beluga whales, these guys go by a lot of different names. They go by white whale, they go by sea canaries. Their native name is siswak, and I'm sorry if I butcher that, if anybody knows the correct pronunciation, but that's just one of many of the names that they're called. They are cetaceans, so these are all marine mammals that live in the ocean full time. And cetaceans are divided into two groups. They're divided into the odontocetes and the mysticetes. The mysticetes are any whale with baleen, and the odontocetes are any whale or porpoise with tooth. So these guys are part of the toothed whale community. And they're distant cousins of the narwhal, which is another Arctic species. So worldly, beluga whales are found pretty much semi-circumpolarly. These guys are only found in the northern hemisphere, which is quite important, and in Arctic and semi-Arctic subpolar regions. And in order to understand a little bit about their lifestyle in Cook Inlet, it's important to know their biology. Because they live in Arctic and subarctic areas, their biology is quite specific and adapted for those living conditions. First off, you have, they're quite robust and stocky. So this body shape, which is quite rotund, it's about 50% fat, and it can be up to 15 centimeters thick in certain parts, depending on the time of the year that you find them. So they have a lot of blubber as insulation to keep them warm in the colder environments. They also have shortened, stockier fins and flukes, which helps with their blood circulation, and it decreases their surface-to-area ratio of skin. They have a really thick melon, which is an adaptation for navigating through ice and locating prey, and it helps them with their echolocation, and that's how they actually produce their sound. They have a shortened beak, which is another adaptation for living in this environment. And they actually don't have a dorsal fin. They'd have what's called a dorsal ridge. And the dorsal ridge is specific for a few marine mammals, and it helps to break the ice in where it's thin enough that they can break through, especially if they're navigating through ice, and it's thin enough they can find an air hole where else they wouldn't be able to. And another thing that's really cool about these guys is they can turn their head about 90 degrees in any direction because they don't have fused vertebrae, and that helps them find prey and navigate as well. So about their size, they're quite small. They're one of the smaller whales. A male, on average, will be about 13 feet long and weigh about 3,300 pounds. A female will be about 12 feet long and weigh about 3,000 pounds, so they're kind of similar. And when it calves, a calf will be about 5 feet and weigh about 100 pounds. So it's just less than half the size of a female when it gives birth. And another adaptation is that as adults, they're all white. So they blend in very well with ice and ice floes and ice packs. However, when they're younger, they're a dark gray in color. And that's one of the ways the scientists use to identify them as age. So the dark gray ones are the calves. Kind of a lighter mottled gray would be a subadult. And the all white ones are your adults. And as I said, these guys are tooth whales. So they're carnivorous. They are pretty generous in what they eat. And so far in all the beluga, they've discovered over 100 types of prey that they've eaten, but that's just what we've discovered. They could be eating more. And this ranges from fish to squid to crabs to clams. And in Cook Inlet, they eat everything, but they really like the salmon and the eulacan. And this is how you guys might normally see them if you go down to Beluga Point or Turnagain Arm. You see a round little hump, and from far away it might look like a white cap. And if the sun gleams off of it, then it'll be the flash. So if you're an observer or a scientist looking for these guys, you actually look for that flash, or you look for the random white cap. And that's usually a beluga whale. And sometimes you get the opportunity to see them kind of come out of the water and spy hop a little bit. But in general, these guys are not acrobatic. Because they're so large, they're very slow movers. They move about, or they swim about 2.5 kilometers per hour. But in saying that, they can travel quite far in a short amount of time. Some stocks up in the north, the Beaufort Sea Stock, will travel about 3,000 kilometers in a given season and then travel back within a few months. So they can travel far. And then they're quite social animals. This is taken at the mouth of a river. And so you can see these guys are usually found in groups of 10 to thousands, depending on where you find them. And within the group, you actually have subgroups. You can barely see it, but there's a calf and a mom pair right there. And this is called a fission-fusion society. So, and a lot of cetaceans have this, a lot of large group cetaceans have this, where they form smaller groups within a larger group, and these smaller groups, actually members leave and come back, and they form different groups. So that's pretty cool. And then one unique aspect about them is they're quite vocal. They're called canaries of the sea. If you're on land near them or on a boat, you can actually hear them click and whistle. And from what I've been told by acousticians, it sounds harmonious. It kind of sounds like they're singing if you listen to a recording, or it sounds like a canary if you can hear them above the surface of the water. And they produce sound at kind of a high frequency because they're kind of smaller individuals. And this is how they produce sound. They push air from their nasal sac, and they have full control over their face and their facial muscles and their melon. So they can change the sound that they're producing based on what sound they would like. If they would like a click, a chirp, a moo even, or a whistle. And this is great for those large pods because it's good for communicating across long distances. And it's particularly good for mating for these guys so they can talk amongst each other and figure out who's a viable candidate. But it's also great for echolocation because they can kind of hone in the noise that they make to find the prey or the specific thing that they're looking for in the water. And if you don't know what echolocation is, I'm going to kind of break it down for you. Echolocation is the same thing that bats do, and most cetaceans, if not all of them, do. But they'll produce a sound, it'll go out into the water, those sound waves will hit something more solid, and then it'll bounce back, and when they hear that sound wave again, or the echo, they can actually pinpoint where the animal or the object is, And by doing it quite often over a longer period of time, you get kind of a sound vision field. So you can see where all the obstacles are, you can see where all the ice packs are. And they can even find ice leads and air holes by doing this. But it's quite great for prey as well. And then belugas live to be about 32, but some have been aged up to 50 based on their teeth. You take the tooth and you cut it in half and you count the rings, just like a tree. And when they're about 5 or 8, that's when they become sexually mature. So a female who's sexually mature will mate in the wintertime. She'll go through gestation over a 14-month period, which means that's when the baby grows. And then the calf will come out in the following spring. It'll nurse for 2 years or up to 2 years. And then the female is, once that's done, she's able to have another baby. So she can only reproduce once every 2 or more years. So let's get to the belugas. There are five stock, or the Alaskan belugas. There's five stocks in Alaska. There's the Beaufort Sea. So I'm just going to start up here and move counterclockwise. So you have the Beaufort Sea, Eastern Chukchi Sea, Eastern Bering, the Bristol Bay stock, and the Cook Inlet stock. And these guys, if you're talking management issues and you're talking about different populations, we usually refer to them as stocks, because if you can identify specific areas that these guys utilize, then you can protect them more and you can manage them better. And as you can see, the Cook Inlet stock is the furthest south, or one of the farther on the southern Alaska, and it's quite isolated from every other stock. And Josh is going to get into a good deal of this, but just so that you guys know, these guys in Cook Inlet only live within Cook Inlet. They don't really travel outside of it very much. You might see the odd one in the Gulf of Alaska, but they don't travel around the peninsula. They stay within Cook Inlet. And as of 2012, there's only about 312 animals estimated to be in this population within Cook Inlet. So if you see one, you're quite lucky. They are classified as critically endangered, so they're highly protected. They are non-migratory. They're not one of the ones that travel far distances, except they may travel within Cook Inlet. They have a decreased habitat range, and this has actually been decreased since the early 90s. So this isn't something that's been happening over a large amount of time. It's quite new for this stock. And they're currently not hunted. No one is allowed to take this animal or to harm this animal at all with this specific stock. So as I mentioned before, these guys are isolated because of their geographic location. If they wanted to, they could swim around that far, but is it worth it? Like, to spend that much energy getting to another area where there's other belugas, they'd have to swim all the way around the Alaskan Peninsula, and there might not be food for them. So it might be energetically better for them, and they might historically have had really good fish runs up in here, so this is why they stayed up in here. So this is what we actually do know about belugas, and I'm going to go very quickly through this because Josh is going to touch in depth on most of these things. I'm just going to give you kind of a heads up of what's coming. So this is the critical habitat as NIMS has slated it, and it's all the red hashed marks. And you can see that encompasses the Ketchumak Bay, the west side of Cook Inlet, and then everything north of that, including the Kenai, Tyonek, Knik Arm, Turnagain Arm, and everywhere around Anchorage. So pretty much anywhere, if you go out and look out the Cook Inlet right now, that's all critical habitat for belugas. And this is where NIMS thinks that they spend most of their time. And they have a lot of data to back this up, but this is why they've decreed that as critical habitat. We know that this is what their population trend looks like from 1994 to 2012. As you can see, from 1994, it was 663 animals, and in 2012, it was 312. So it's been over a 50% decrease in just this short amount of time. We know that, so they were hunted, and some of the stocks still are hunted. And this green line represents when the moratorium was placed on the Cook Inlet stock, so no more subsistence hunting except for extraneous situations.
Here, the speaker is referring to a graph provided by the National Marine Fisheries Service in which the green horizontal line she referred to represents the 1999 moratorium on hunting for Cook Inlet belugas. Blue circles around the years 1999, 2004, and 2007 to 2012 represent years in which agreements existed between the National Marine Fisheries Service and Alaska Native groups banning all beluga hunting. A link to the complete set of slides can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Starting in, I believe it was either 2008, yeah, 2008 is when they became endangered, like they were classified as critically endangered. So from 2008 forward, there's been no hunting whatsoever. And we know that there, we know from past research efforts from the aerial monitoring, we know what the population looks like, but that's not the only aerial monitoring project that has happened. There's many from many different companies, many different people, many different scientists, but they just don't, they haven't collaborated all their numbers yet. But most of these were undertaken in the summer months, and that's when it's ice-free and it's easier to count the belugas, and they're more likely to be up where we think they're going to be. We know a great deal of information from photo ID data taken a few years ago, and from that, you can take a picture of the right or the left side of an animal, and if you have any distinguishable marks, then any other sighting of that animal, you can get a lot of good data from it, like where they are, what time of the year they're there. You can even get age data if you see them more and more over time. We know a bit of information about where they go and when they go there from satellite tags, but we have very few animals that have been tagged. And then we know a little bit of information about genetic studies. However, they haven't been compared to any other closer stocks to see if these guys are genetically independent. And then we actually know a lot about from the subsistence hunters themselves. And this is just a list of things that they used the beluga for when they did hunt them. But from their oral knowledge and from talking to elders and stories from their elders, we can gather that there were lots of belugas in Cook Inlet many, many, many years ago. And now it's, you know, if you see one, you only see a couple or 10 at a time. And they can tell you where they used to hunt them. They can tell you where they used to see them. They can tell you a whole plethora of information and even like behavior information that we just can't really, we don't have enough data for all of that just yet. And then we know that they do have threats. They have natural threats, they have human-related threats, and then they have threats that are caused by both humans and natural causes. So human-related threats include industry, it includes boat strikes, it used to include hunting for the stock, but not anymore. And then in a combination of natural and human-related are climate change and actually food availability because everybody's competing for the fish up here. So as a result, these guys have been declared as critically endangered population and they're on the brink of extinction because their numbers are so few and their population is not increasing. And what that means for anybody who wants to do work in Cook Inlet is that if they want to go ahead and do work in one of the critical habitat areas, they actually have to obtain special permission for that. And so that takes time and money. And they might not be allowed to do it depending on what their project is. They might be allowed to do it, but they have to, if their project is going to cause any harm to the belugas, then they have to find a way around that. And that might be doing work at an alternate time site or an alternate time in the year. It might be hiring some observers to look for the mammals and then stopping work when they're around. But it does make it difficult. It also means that now there's no more subsistence hunting of these animals in Cook Inlet until the population can reach a sustainable yield. And most of that, but what we also do know is that they still aggregate in areas of high human impact. So you saw the map where the Cook Inlet's the critical habitat. A lot of it's in northern Cook Inlet. Well, that's around the Port of Anchorage and up Cook Inlet in Eagle Bay. And they're up there for a reason, whether it's food, whether it's safety, but they're up there for a reason, and there's a lot of human activity around that area, and they haven't left. But what we don't know is what they exactly do in the winter. Where do they go? We have a little bit of information, but not enough to make any conclusive judgments. We think that they're actually becoming more of a resident population in Upper Cook Inlet, but because it's hard to spot them in the ice, we don't really know that. And we don't really know what their winter food source is. Are they living off the blubber that they build on in the summer months? Or are they finding when the tide comes in, if there's a saltwater layer on the bottom and there's fish coming, like saltwater fish coming up with that, are they eating that fish? And then is that enough to actually sustain the population in the wintertime? And we can't exactly pinpoint one factor at fault for the continued population decline over the past 15 years or so. However, we do have some, Josh is going to talk about some of the work that's been going on right now and how that's going to lead to a potential answer.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with marine biologist Jennifer Kate and aquatic biologist Josh Moffey. Their presentation, entitled Where Have All the Whales Gone? The Cook Inlet Beluga Story, was recorded at and hosted by the Anchorage Museum on January 29th. Josh Moffey was next to speak.
I'm used to standing up here not having a microphone, so this will be different. A little bit about me. I've been studying biology for 24 years. I started out doing fisheries work. I've spent first 12 years doing extensively fisheries work. After that, I moved into freshwater invertebrates. I did freshwater insects and freshwater mussels. I've worked everywhere from the North Slope, Oregon, Washington, Michigan, quite a bit around the Great Lakes. So I've got both freshwater, I've worked in the Bering Sea, I've worked the Pacific Coast off Oregon and Washington. So I've got freshwater and marine water experience for fisheries. The last 6 years now, I've been doing marine mammal work. Being a biologist, I travel wherever they send me for work. The last 6 years, I've worked four different beluga projects and three other marine mammal projects in the Arctic. A year and a half ago, I started my master's at Alaska Pacific University under Dr. Leslie Cornick in the Marine Ecology and Physiology Lab studying beluga whales. I'll touch on that a little bit later. So here's a little bit more detailed version of the population graph that Jen put up. I've dropped off the moratorium and the years of harvest. I've also added in what you're seeing is you're seeing the red lines for the population, and you're seeing these big bars that start shrinking down. What those bars are, those are the confidence intervals. So when we first started doing surveys for the population, we had really big errors. As we honed down the tech, or as NIMS honed down their techniques and got better resolution cameras, those confidence intervals shrink down. We're very confident when NIMS comes out with a population estimate. They flew a survey in June of 2014. The results from that are due out within the next couple weeks, hopefully. A couple trends. I don't have a trend line up here. From 1994 to 1998, 47% reduction in the beluga population. From 2002 to 2012, the last 10 years, we've only got, this green line here is a 0.6% population decline. Not a very big reduction every year, but these animals are very low number. That population, at the current state, they are going to go extinct. NIMS figures that in the foreseeable future, even if we get a reversal in this trend, they're still going to be listed as critically endangered for this foreseeable future. So what happens when NIMS decides to list a species is they go through a whole review process. That occurred in 2007. In 2008, the first thing they did was they listed the Cook Inlet belugas as a distinct population. As Jen said, they're isolated. They're not moving out of Cook Inlet. They're here all year round. There's no other belugas moving in or out of Cook Inlet. This population is distinct. Once it was decided it was distinct, then NIMS could go ahead and list them as endangered, which they did later in 2008. The population has continued to decline, and one of the major issues, as Jen said, there's been a range contraction. The big range shift happened sometime between 2000 and 2005. Over that time period, the Cook Inlet belugas moved from using the middle and upper Cook Inlet to using an area pretty well around the forelands and the Upper Cook Inlet. This map is the detailed listing for critical habitat. The red areas here, mid-inlet, the west side, are historically significant areas. They're not seen down around home very much anymore. We're getting occasional sightings down there still, occasional sightings along the western arm of Cook Inlet, or the western shore of Cook Inlet, sorry. And the middle Cook Inlet they're using in the winter. The green area you're seeing up top around Anchorage, this is critical habitat area one. This is the area that NIMS has deemed extremely important. These are the summer feeding grounds, the Susitna River, the Little Susitna, Eagle River, Chickaloon, 3 Mile are all aggregations for summer feeding. Chickaloon Bay and the flats off of the Big Sioux are calving areas. So this is an area that NIMS considers very important. Any projects happening in this area are under a high amount of scrutiny. The exception in Upper Cook Inlet is the area off of Anchorage, Port of Anchorage, and the flight line into Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Part of the endangered species listing, NIMS is allowed to weigh the cost-benefit of protecting certain areas. What they decided was that area was important enough for Alaska economically and it was a transit area for the belugas, so they're not spending a whole lot of time, they're just moving through that area. Like Jen said, they're still seen fairly regularly around Chip Creek and the Port of Anchorage. But that area is not, it gets an exemption. So it's not critical habitat for the belugas. So the question, as Jen posed it, is where have all the belugas gone? Well, we've got a few possibilities for the decline. Biological factors, there's been a lot of change in the salmon runs. We have record high red returns and record low king returns. The red returns returning into the Kenai River, we have a very large number of dip netters, we have a large number of set netters, and we have a large number of drift gill netters. So this may limit access to the red run for the belugas. Yulikon, some of the rivers are doing good, so Susitna's still got a great run. The belugas show up right after the Yulikon do over there. Turnagain Arm, not as many Yulikon. We're not seeing as many beluga over there in the spring when the Yulikon come in. And as Jen said, we're still not sure what they're eating in the winter. There is saltwater intrusion all the way up to Anchorage. And it's deep up here. So there's definitely times where you can watch them. They're down for quite a while. They're a generalist feeder. They may very well be feeding on fish that are up in there. Or they may be living off blubber stores. Another biological factor that is a possibility for decline is interspecific competition. Competition from other animals. Salmon sharks are being seen further up Cook Inlet than have previously been seen. And harbor seals, well, anybody that's fished the Kenai River can tell you they're quite a few miles up the river now. We're not sure how these interact with the beluga population. We're not sure if their numbers are increasing because the belugas are decreasing. It's a possibility. But that's one of the factors where people are looking at. Other possibilities are environmental factors. We have warmer water in Cook Inlet than we have historically. We're not sure what that means for the belugas, what that means for fish runs, changes in bathymetry. Anybody that's lived in Anchorage and driven up to Girdwood over the last 20 years can tell you there's been a huge change in the bathymetry of Turnagain Arm. Used to be that the near shore by the highway was the deep side of the arm. The belugas were seen over there quite regularly. What's happened over the last 10, 15 years is those mudflats have built up, and now the deep side is on the far side of the arm. You look over there, the whales are still there, but they're hard to spot. You get that quick flash through a set of binoculars, and that's the only reason you know they're there. So the bathymetry changes may change the way that the tides are flowing in those areas, and the directions are flowing, different circulation. And the other flow issue is river flows. Recent studies have shown that the belugas are highly efficient at picking the rivers with the high floats. If Chicoloon has a high flow and the Little Sioux has a low flow, the belugas tend to shift. They'll go to that area with high flow. Human factors. As Jen said, at one point hunting was a problem. Well, not a problem. The population was good. You know, 100 years ago, the estimate was 3,000 animals. But with all the other changes, that may have been enough to push it a little bit too far. We're not sure. We haven't seen that return yet. But with animals reproducing every 2 or 3 years, they've got a slow growth rate. It may take us 30 or 40 years before we see a change. Another big human factor is increased development. Anchorage has grown, Wasilla has grown, Kenai, Soldotna have grown. There's just a lot more activity in Cook Inlet. This includes increased vessel traffic and oil and gas development. We're not sure how these impact the belugas. So other possibilities for decline that aren't quite as obvious, we've got a lot more chemicals in Cook Inlet than we used to. We've got pharmaceutical discharges, we've got PCBs and PBDEs. The PBDEs are a very recently identified chemical. They're a fire retardant, which occurs in a lot of different products. The PBDEs have been shown to cause stillborns and death shortly after birth in orca whales in BC, as well as specifically beluga whales in the St. Lawrence River in Canada. So that's a possibility that could be impacting them. We also have a lot more pollution, just the number of people. And there's just so much more activity. It's going to all add up. So what does this mean for Cook Inlet? Well, we've got a lot of upcoming development. Yeah. All these projects are stuff that could be coming up. A lot of them in the upper inlet. Port of Anchorage, Kinnick Arm Crossing, offshore energy was proposed for off of Fire Island. That's all critical one habitat. So there's potential that there may be more interaction with belugas in the next little while. But one of the big things, one of the big values that is hard to quantify, we can put a dollar figure on all this. This is easy to deal with. We don't know how to value this. Yeah. How many times do you sit along turning an arm and just hope to see a whale? That intrinsic value is a big value. So current research, one of the big ongoing projects is the photo identification database. It's headed up by Tamara McGuire at LGL Alaska Research. They have identified, and this is one of those numbers that's going to seem really weird, they have identified 312 distinct animals. This does not mean that they have identified every animal in the population today. This database has been compiled over 7 or 8 years. Some of these 312 animals are deceased, and they know this from necropsies and being able to confirm photos of dead animals. So they've got a good database, and it's been good for tracking. It allows Tamara to identify a whale that's got a calf, and then age that calf over time. As that calf develops identifiable marks and is still with the mother, they can give that animal a distinct number. The sightings go from Eagle Bay, Turnagain Arm, all the way south. The photo database includes animals around the Kenai River. So far, and the original thought was at one point somebody suggested that there's only 12 animals down the Kenai River. They could possibly be a distinct 12 animals. They're not. The photo identification has allowed the tracking of animals, and you can see that whole fission-fusion society that Jen was talking about. You'll get 12 animals down the Kenai, then you'll get a different 12 animals. Those 12 animals that were originally seen down in the Kenai all of a sudden are up in front of the Susitna with another 100 animals. They may turn around and go to Chicoloon. So this has allowed a more efficient method of tracking individual animals. Jen talked about traditional ecological knowledge. A lot of effort being put into this right now to get the information that the native hunters have. We can't go back 20 years and try and recreate a data set for that. They knew where they were 20 years ago. They know the areas they hunted. So that collection is very important to future work. Another thing that's being done is remote studies. There have been 3 or 4 different passive acoustic studies. This is putting out hydrophones in the water on the bottom of Cook Inlet, letting them sit in areas that appear to be critical habitat or critical high-use habitat for the belugas, and coming back in 6 months, picking them up, and seeing what they get for recordings. Another thing that has been done over the last few years is video monitoring. This allows somebody to sit in Anchorage and control a camera mounted on a distant river and watch belugas real time, or watch the river real time and track belugas. We can also record that stuff, record the river when we can't have an observer there, and go back and watch that later. So it's a good, video monitoring is a great way to get a lot of data from remote stations. So what am I doing for research? How am I contributing to what we know about belugas? I'm in the process of compiling multiple data sets from multiple different projects. I'm trying to build a methodology to compare these data sets, because not every project can collect data in the same way. So if we can standardize the way that the data is collected, that would be optimal. NIFS is currently working on that. In the meantime, I'm trying to work with what we have to build one database. On top of the fact that the data was collected in different ways, it was also collected on different platforms. Some of it was airborne information, observers flying over Cook Inlet, recording what they saw from airplanes. There's ship-based observers out there. There were protected species observers that were land-based for different projects. And there's just some baseline data that was collected for a variety of different projects. Once I get all of this compiled, I'm hoping to be able to perform a habitat use assessment over a time period and an area of Upper Cook Inlet that nobody has managed to do yet. When they fly the aerial surveys for the population, that's a very limited time window. They fly over 2 weeks, once a year, once every other year now. So I'm hoping that I'll be able to build on what we know for the habitat use. Data gaps, some of this is pretty obvious. What we want to fill in is that winter food source is a big one. If we can figure out, did they require all the energy from the summer feeding to get them through the winter, or are they supplementing it with winter food sources? We've done satellite tagging, 98 through 2000. So the hope is that we can deploy a new set of satellite tags. NIFS has permits in place. They're trying to get funding for that. So now that the population has shifted into Upper Cook Inlet, if we could get new distribution data off of satellite tags, it would be really beneficial. Another study that NIFS would like to do in the next little while is a hearing assessment. They would like to actually figure out what frequencies and how sensitive Cook Inlet belugas are to noise. Cook Inlet is a very noisy place. Not just the ship traffic, the airplanes, it's also a high load sediment. That background silt movement is very loud. There's been studies conducted on beluga hearing, but it's always occurred either in captive environments or in places like Bristol Bay, where it's a totally different soundscape. So having an actual hearing study would allow us a better information to determine what human sound impacts the beluga whales. The other thing that would be nice and NIFS is doing hopefully all three of these as one grouped study. So they'll have all of this at once. NIFS wants to take biopsies and do some toxicology work. That would really tell us, are those PBDEs affecting the population here the way they are in the St. Lawrence River. So that would give us a lot, those four things alone would give us a lot of information about the belugas in Cook Inlet. In the meantime, it's mitigation and conservation efforts. As Jen said, special permits are required for a lot of work that happens in Cook Inlet. Incidental harassment authorizations allow for what NMFS calls takes. This means that a certain level of exposure of noise is allowed. This is highly restrictive. It's allowed on only a certain number of animals. And NMFS has started to mention in a couple different places, a couple different public forums now, it may be a limited time before they stop issuing IHAs. So that could definitely change what goes on in Cook Inlet. In the meantime, if you don't want to deal with that and you're working in the shoreline, working at low tide when you're not impacting the belugas, it's a good way to minimize impact. Seasonal and area restrictions, again, working in areas when the belugas aren't there. And there's possibility of, if the population gets low enough, restricting vessel traffic in certain areas. So in summary, yes, Cook Inlet belugas are an endangered species. The population is continuing to decline, and we still don't have an exact cause of why they're declining. We got a few different things that are possibilities. Most likely, it's a combination of a bunch of those factors. We're going to have to figure out which of those factors we can minimize, hopefully minimizing the impact on the belugas. And that brings me to the end. Does anybody have any questions?
We were only able to include two of the questions posed to the speakers following the presentation. First, an audience member asks what it would take for the Cook Inlet belugas to no longer be considered an endangered species.
I don't know what NMFS has. NMFS hasn't published that. They haven't made that public. But I know that they just did the assessment and have had discussions with the Tyonek natives. They're saying there will be no hunting for the next, through 2018 for sure. We're still seeing a decline. Until we start seeing an increase, everybody right now is just so focused on getting them stabilized. Nobody's even thought long-term about when can we remove them.
Another audience member asks about the status of other beluga populations outside of Cook Inlet.
Bristol Bay population is actually on the increase right now. Chukchi and the Beaufort are both stable. And the St. Lawrence River is seeing a slight decline. The St. Lawrence River is highly polluted. They come up and they're literally, the Canadian government lists them as toxic waste. They send special crews out to pick up carcasses on the St. Lawrence. It's that sad, yeah. There's a lot of chemicals in the Great Lakes. I don't want to think about what I've ingested living in that area, but. So a quick comparison, St. Lawrence River has approximately 3,000 whales. They're seeing the same number of carcasses in the St. Lawrence River as we see every year in Cook Inlet. We're not sure why that is. A lot of people are thinking that because Alaskans right now are hyper-focused on belugas, everybody's reporting them. There's so much small aircraft traffic over Upper Cook Inlet. NMFS is pretty confident that they get stranding reports for every carcass. The populations around the world are fairly stable.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with marine biologist Jennifer Kate and aquatic biologist Josh Maffey. Their presentation entitled Where Have All the Whales Gone? The Cook Inlet Beluga Story was recorded at and hosted by the Anchorage Museum on January 29th. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Evan Erickson.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, Just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.